Well, how many of us at one time in our lives have wanted to pray for a financial miracle? That's what we're going to talk with James Parrish about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Parrish, author of more than 30 books. He's the editor-in-chief of ChristianMoney.com. Now, by the age of 30, he was a multimillionaire. By 40, he went bankrupt. Why? He was the victim of an embezzlement scheme. He'll talk to you about that. He believes that the man upstairs is waiting to deliver a financial miracle. But you got to ask. Jim Parrish, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Hey, George, good to be back with you. I have to tell you, this book just strikes a chord with your listeners every time I'm on.
It sure is.
It goes crazy.
Everybody needs to pray for some kind of miracle these days, Jim.
Yes, sir.
Hey, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing since you were last on with me.
Well, life is going forward. I continue to spend my life just having fun. I play lead trumpet for a big band, and we rehearse every Thursday night. We have a couple of performances a month. I've now moved up from first-degree black belt in Taekwondo to second-degree black belt, and I'm now heading up a program teaching women self-defense in the area, young women, college-age women self-defense on college campuses. Doing that, continuing to write. I've got a live radio show now that I do on Sunday nights for 2 hours. So life is going forward. I've got kids graduating from college and actually making money. My son bought lunch for me the other day. He said, "No, Dad, put away your credit card. I'm making good money now." And I'll tell you what, that's the greatest feeling in the world.
Yep, it is. When you don't have to reach for that bill, that's the
that's
way
right.
to
when
go.
When your kids are buying your lunch, it can't be any better than that.
Jim, how do you go from being a multimillionaire to bankrupt? What happened?
Yeah, this is the problem, and a lot of people just simply don't want to understand it. And if you read the book, in fact, I said to myself, I'm going to be on the show. I better pull this book out and start paging through it a little bit. And I started crying here at my desk 10 minutes ago, and I said, I've got to pull myself together. Some of these memories, they're there, but I kind of block them out. But it was a real tragedy. My own brother was my accountant, and I've always believed if you can't trust family, who can you trust?
I remember this.
And I got a call from my outside auditor one morning, and he told me there are some problems with missing money. And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's a substantial amount of money missing." I said, "How much?" He said, "Well, so far we've come up with $130,000 that we can't account for." And I said, "Well, the only two people that have access to our banking is myself and my brother." And he said, "Stop right there. What did you just say?" I said, "Well, the only two people that have access to our banking is myself and my brother." And he said, "Stop right there." And he said, "I don't want to tell you what's going on, but you just gave yourself the answer to what's going on."
Yeah.
So
he didn't want to tell you, but he wanted you to figure it out, didn't he?
Right, right. So it turned out that my own brother embezzled. We stopped counting when we got over $2 million.
Oh.
And it was devastating to me because it was our operating cash flow. We were completely wiped out. I lost all my businesses, and I was of the mindset that why save a lot of money in personal bank accounts when I have these great businesses and I could keep putting money back into the business. I took a great salary, a fantastic salary, but I also put a lot of money back in the business,
sure,
keep a lot of money in savings personally. And so when the businesses went under and the $2 million was gone, we lost our home. We lost our cars. We literally talked about, my wife and I, about being homeless. I mean, it was surreal. I mean, one day I'm on TV shows being picked up by limousines at the airport, and then I'm in bankruptcy court. I've lost my home, my cars, everything. And it happened so quickly, it was literally finding this information out. It was only a matter of weeks before I had to shut everything down, let all my employees go. In fact, my last employee, I couldn't pay him, so I agreed to give him our phone system as his final paycheck.
The phone system, and he took it?
Yeah, he accepted the phone system as his final paycheck, and that was the end. And the other day, my wife and I, we were driving through Orlando, which I had multiple offices around the country for my financial planning business, and we drove past a brick building in Lake Mary, Florida, where I used to have one of my branch offices. And I said to my wife, I said, "Remember that building?" She said, yeah, that was one of the offices. And we kind of have these moments where it's like that old life, it almost seems like just a distant memory or dream from the past kind of comes back and pops back as we kind of run across old locations.
A dream or a nightmare, Jim?
Yeah, more of a nightmare, I would say. Absolutely.
And if I were him, I would have said, take this phone. I don't want this phone system. I want my check.
Yeah, well, he took the phone system, and we're still great friends today. We still do work together. This one individual is one of my key employees, and it's one of those things where it's hard for people to understand it because they say, look, you shouldn't trust someone that much that they could do that to you. But at the same time, I mean, it's happened to Wayne Newton, Barry Manilow. I mean, how many people get in this position where you're the guy, you're the front man. I'm traveling, I'm on planes, I'm doing radio and TV, I'm writing books, and then I've got somebody behind the scenes running my money for me, and all of a sudden the money's gone. And it became surreal.
Yeah.
My brother claimed he was going to clear everything up. It was a misunderstanding. And that was the last time he actually communicated with me because he then said, I will no longer speak to you. You have to speak to my attorney.
Oh, your own brother.
Yeah, my own brother. And that's when I knew, George, that it was for real.
What did he do with the money, if I could ask? Did you ever track that?
Yeah, we did. And it's really tragic what happened with the money. We understand that, all those bad things that you do when you have too much money, he was involved in pretty much all of that. His marriage ended in divorce as a result of the things he was doing with the money, maintaining sort of a separate life, if you will. And,
a very clandestine life, quiet and secret.
It was like one of those Lifetime movies, where the guy's got another family going and all kinds of things. It was like that. It was just like something that you couldn't believe.
Surreal.
I just could not believe it.
She, the wife, must have been in shock as well, huh? His wife.
Well, our greater family, I mean, our extended family, we're from Chicago. And, being in a Midwest city like that, we still have a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins and extended family in Chicago, and no one could believe it. I mean, the word was just buzzing around. Did you hear what happened to Jimmy? You hear what happened to Jimmy? No one could believe it. And then when it turned out it was my own brother, it was, wow, nobody could process this. And people would ask me, is that your biological real brother? And I said, yes. And were you guys in a disagreement or a fight or what would provoke him to do this? And no, I treated him like royalty. He never went to college. I put him in jobs that he probably wasn't qualified to do, but I had people train him and paid him a lot of money. And when he needed a down payment for a house, I stepped up with the down payment. He'd end up tagging along with me to go buy a new custom suit, and I'd feel bad and say, we'll make it two.
Yeah, he never went without with you.
No, it was certainly not provoked by anything that I did. So, I felt so victimized because it wasn't just a random stranger. It would have almost been easier if it was a stranger off the street that robbed me.
Yeah.
But my own family member, after all that I had done for him, it was just such a deep betrayal. That probably was the worst part of it all.
Did you ever see that in him when he was a kid, Jim?
No,
need to do these things?
Yeah, well, he's 6 years younger than I am. And so there was always sort of that dynamic that he was the spoiled younger child of the three of us. But outside of that, kind of stereotypical family situation, I didn't notice anything along these lines, no.
Tell me he cried in your arms after this.
No, he didn't.
That's a problem.
And I had to sue him, and I did sue him, and I did get a judgment of $4.7 million. And I also have to tell you that I'm not the only company, that there have been other victims since me. And
from him?
Yes, of him. And I can say that publicly because there are court records and so forth. In fact, there's a felony case pending right now against him.
Oh, is that
this very thing?
Is that his first felony case?
No, it's not.
Oh, geez. Has he been in jail before?
He was convicted. He was tried on another case about a year ago and was found not guilty, which was shocking. But this case has yet to come to trial. But another company, separately from me, civilly sued him like I did, and they got a judgment against him. And this is the same case that's now a criminal case. And so, and I got calls over the years from people because I had published my story in my book. I published it on the internet, and I got calls over the years from people saying, hey, I just Googled his name, and this just happened to me. So I wish I could tell you I was the only one, the first and the last, but that's not the case.
And, of course, judgments don't mean you collect. You got to work. You got to do that, too, on your own.
How this worked was, so here I was, financial guru, financial expert in bankruptcy, and I got the judgment really more as a moral victory to be able to clear my name, you know, to try to, you know, give the public some sense of what happened here. And so the judgment became owned by the bankruptcy court as an asset of my bankruptcy. So they then had the right to pursue him for money, but I doubt they ever got anything. That's what I understand, that they didn't get anything. But the funniest moment in bankruptcy was when the judge said to me, oh, so you're an author. What was the name of your most recent book? And I said, Money Management for Those Who Don't Have It. And at that point, the judge erupted in laughter, and everyone else did. And I didn't know if I should cry or laugh, so yeah. I laughed. And we had a good laugh out of that, but that was my latest book. So that was one of the humorous moments of it all. It was just surreal, just sitting there. You know, I was the guy that would write about bankruptcy court or do a TV report about a bankruptcy of a celebrity. I wasn't the guy to ever be sitting in bankruptcy court, but there I was.
When you hit the bottom, how did you pull yourself up?
Well, as I outline in the book, I planned out my own suicide 3 times in detail. In fact, I sort of told my wife in maybe coded language, like, do you want to still stay married to me? Do you want to, you just let me go. I need to, I didn't say I'm going to kill myself in those words to her, but I kind of gave her an out, if you will. And she never gave up on me. She never gave in. She always stuck with me. And that was one of the most amazing miracles of all of this. I mean, people ask me, well, what happened to your marriage? Of course you got divorced, right? And I said, no, we didn't get divorced. We're going to be married 29 years this year. But there were some low moments. I remember one time in particular that I was so upset, I was throwing up blood. And
you were that stressed. Wow.
Yeah, and I had to be put on medication. I had to see 2 different doctors. It was really like the edge of reality was slipping away from me, and that's when I got to the moment that I really changed the way that I was praying, because all along, George, I would go to God and say, here's my plan. I've got it all figured out. And God, please bless this plan I have. And it wasn't working. And that's when I stopped bringing God my plans. And I simply went to God with a blank pad of paper. And that's how I've lived my life the last several years, is allowing God to come up with a plan. And of course, he's going to bless his own plan, right? So it makes a lot more sense. I didn't get it. I'm a slow learner when it comes to things like this. So that's really the central theme of the book, is that God is there with answers, with direction for you, no matter how bad your situation is. And some people have it as bad as I had it. Many say, look, if you can make it through that, I can make it through my foreclosure, or I can make it through my job loss. But I know there are people out there that are probably going through something equally or even worse than what I went through, but God was there with me, my wife was there, my family was there with me.
How long did it take you to turn things around?
It wasn't overnight, and this is one of the other lessons in my book, is many times people are looking for a quick answer, a quick overnight. Part of it was my stubbornness, really, like I said, not going to God, asking God for his plan, but coming up with my own plan. It was probably not until around 2006, which would have been almost 5 years, that I was basically living in the wilderness, if you will, to use the metaphor, without a lot of money. And my sister had a mortgage business, and she said, look, you don't have a mortgage broker's license. You don't have any training in this field. I'll bring you in as a clerk. So I took a $300 a week job. Now, this is a, you know, I was making six figures when I was 22 years old, and way into the six figures.
Right.
And I take a job for $300 a week. And I took that job, and I was glad to have that job. And it gave me a chance to learn the mortgage industry. I became licensed as a mortgage broker. I ended up owning half of a mortgage company within a couple of years. So I just needed somewhere to restart myself. And that was kind of the rebirth of my professional career. And I then got a real estate license, became a 50% owner of a real estate firm, and have just continued to go from there. I'm no longer doing real estate or lending, but I'm just doing writing full-time now. I have a blog. I write books. I've got a live radio show, and have a life that I just is better than I could ever have had before. I mean, honestly, it is a great life that I have. We have a wonderful home here, 5 minutes from the ocean. We have a sailboat. We have two dogs. My kids are all graduating from college and becoming self-sufficient. My house is going to be empty soon with just me and my wife and our two dogs, and life couldn't be any better.
How many people, though, Jim, can bounce back after hitting the bottom like you did?
You know, George, I think that I have to give God all the credit, my family, but I also want to say this, that most people have no idea what they're capable of until they're put in a situation like this. You might think, I could never make it through something like that, but if put in that situation, you could do so much more than you think you can. Every time that I thought to myself, oh, tomorrow we're losing the house, I don't know what I'm going to do, where are we going to live, there would be a door that would open, some solution would take place. There would be another opportunity for us to move into even a better house. So a lot of the things we worry about are really, it's unnecessary worry. But I think human beings, I see this in the martial arts school, we'll bring somebody in that's 50 pounds overweight, they can only do one or two push-ups, and within a couple of weeks, we got them doing 20 push-ups, they've lost 10 or 15 pounds. You just don't know what you're capable of as a person.
You have to be able to do it, though. You have to have that willpower, don't you?
Yes, you do. You can't give up. And I'll be honest with you, I gave up several times, but it was my family that wouldn't give up on me that kept me in the game because I was ready. I was down in my car with a gun, a loaded gun.
Oh, gee.
And I was in my car at the beach ready to kill myself, and that's how bad it got. And it wasn't the loss of the money. It was probably mostly just the sense of betrayal. My whole self-esteem and self-image was all wrapped up in this being this financial guy, you know, this financial expert on all these TV and radio shows, and now I'm bankrupt, and I was just completely devastated. From one end to the other, my self-image was gone, and I thought the only way out was to kill myself.
At that moment you were going to pull that trigger, what was it that made you stop?
I honestly reached this point where I said to myself, if I'm going to kill myself, it can't really get any worse than this. So why not just live it out and see what happens?
Precisely.
And that's, I'll be honest with you, that's exactly what was going through my mind. And when I reached that particular time, and that's the only time that I actually got that far with my plan, although I had made three separate plans, I kind of came back from there and said, well, I could be dead right now, so I'm just going to get up and go on with my life, and nothing can really hurt me now because I could be dead.
So, and get on with your life, you did.
Today, it can't be any worse than being dead.
James, we're going to come back and talk more about how to pray for a financial miracle in the last hour. Not only will we take calls, but I want you to share a story that if you've ever been as destitute as Jim Paris was, I want you to share that with us next hour. Well, some time ago, I did a couple Beyond Belief television shows with James Paris. He did a great job, as he's doing here on Coast to Coast. And you can watch that by going to beyondbelief.com. Special promotion, 99 cents for the month to watch anything and as much as you can watch. Simply go to this website, www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, James Paris with us, how to pray for a financial miracle. So, Jim, if you don't pray to start, can you still pull yourself out of this mess?
Well, I think there is, obviously, you know, the human ability to try to find an answer. And a lot of people, you know, are successful that way. I was successful that way for many years, just relying on myself for the most part. But then I got into waters that were just far too deep for me to be able to deal with it on my own. So I think that certainly to the extent that you can, I always look at praying as kind of a partnership between you and God. You're going to do your best. You're going to try to do what you can do to solve the problem, and you're going to ask for God's help and ask for God's direction. So I don't look at it like God's simply going to drop a bag of money on your doorstep, although that does happen, and we hear stories of that kind of thing happening. I think a more realistic prayer is approaching God, asking for some ideas, an action plan. What can I be doing? And then listening, writing those down, and then actually acting on those plans, moving in a direction. We hear from so many people that say, look, I thought it was hopeless, and sat down, prayed, took an hour, wrote down a bunch of ideas, and put some job applications out there, some resumes, contacted some friends on Facebook, and here I am 2-3 days later, I've got a job, and I was unemployed. So a lot of times it really has to do with an attitude that you have. If you get super negative and you're not going to do anything, you're not going to take any action, George, it ends up kind of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, it sure does. Now, let's couple this with what's going on in this country today, James, where jobs have been lost, manufacturing sectors have gone by the wayside. What do you have to do to re-educate yourself if you've been trained in something and you just are out of a job?
Right. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is reinventing yourself. And I had to do this because I had a securities firm and I had all kinds of employees and offices, and that all went away and I decided to go in a different direction. And so now it's just me. I have a business partner. We've got a staff, freelancers, a handful of people that do different things for us, but it's pretty much an employee-free type of a business that we have set up. But so many people today have found that the job that they were thriving in is now gone. So you could sit on your front porch and pray all day, but if the factory is closed and you're just committed that you want to go back to work at the factory, that may just not be realistic. So I'll give you an example. A friend of mine never went to college, so he goes to college for 18 months. He becomes a respiratory therapist. He laughed when he told me he makes over $100,000 a year. He says, Jim, I wear a lab coat and a stethoscope. I walk around the hospital. People think I'm a doctor. And he said, I even make more money than some of the beginning doctors. And I only went to college for 18 months. We hear stories like this all the time, especially within the medical field. Also, another field is computers. There are places you can go now on the internet for free to learn how to become a computer coder, where you don't even go to college. You can just learn this on your own on the internet. So there are so many different fields. As we're finding the factory is closing, we're finding these other opportunities are opening up and people have to make a transition. Now, this is not anything new. We used to always say when I did financial seminars years ago that during your 40 years of working, you'll probably have 5 to 7 different careers. So we kind of look at this as a new phenomenon that you've got to reinvent yourself. But it's really always been the case. But I think it's a little bit more the case today because of what's going on with technology. But with technology, there's all kinds of opportunities. I mean, just learning to build websites, which is something someone can learn that in a weekend. And think of all the businesses in your community that don't have a website or need help with a website, or even, you know, add that to your resume. So you go get a job and you can take over the company website instead of, you know, just bringing your set of skills you have now. You can also have the web programming skill to add to it. So there's so many things today that you can do with very, very little education.
Now, when you talk about prayer, what is your definition of that? You know, because when people hear the word prayer, they immediately think you got to run to church.
Right, right. And I think prayer happens anywhere. I prayed right before I came on the radio show tonight, asking God to give me the right words to say and to give me wisdom. And that was a legitimate prayer. I didn't have to be in a church building to speak to God. Prayer is communication between us and God. And I think where we miss it, where I missed it for so many years, is I looked at it as it was me talking. So imagine you're on the telephone with someone and you never shut up. You just keep going on and on and on and on, and you never let the other person talk. That wouldn't be very interesting for them, and you wouldn't be getting anything from them. You're just simply spewing your information. That, for most people, is what prayer is. It is them saying what they need to say to God, and that's okay, but I think that there's another part of prayer where we're quiet, and we listen, and we wait to hear from God. And there's examples of that, you know, all throughout the scriptures of you know, men of God, women of God, hearing from God. Now, it may not be necessarily an audible voice, but I think that when you spend those hours of quiet time listening to God, you start to hear a voice. You start to hear a communication that begins to happen, but it doesn't happen while you're playing with your iPad and you've got one eye on your cell phone and you're kind of fidgeting. You've got to set aside that time and get away from the gadgets. So, George, I think it's a two-way communication between us and God.
It sure is. And what's your definition of God?
Well, I personally am a Christian. I know that not everyone that listens to this show is a Christian. That's my faith. But I know a lot of people who would say, look, I don't know where I'm at with my faith. I believe there's something bigger than me, but I don't know what it is. I don't have all the details in front of me. I don't know if I believe, for example, in traditional Christianity or the Bible. There are people probably listening right now, and I address that in my book. I simply challenge people, forget about all that and just pray and ask God to help you and ask God to reveal himself to you, and he will. And you know, my view is I'm a Christian. I believe in Jesus Christ as my Savior, but I know other people have other faiths and other views, and frankly, there's a lot of people that have really no faith. They just don't really know what to believe, and so my book is really targeted towards people who are open, people who are open to just, you know, something new, listening to God. If God's out there, is he going to say something to me? And I've had people email me literally telling me that they did this, and it was almost scary to them what they felt. They, like, had chills. They had a feeling of a presence that was communicating with them that they had never felt before, and they were scared by this. Because they had never felt the presence of God before. And I'll tell you what, there are moments like that where when you feel the communion with God, that it can almost be a little bit scary to feel God's presence. And many people have never felt that. It's sad to say.
What's the old saying in Matthew? Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you.
Right, and those are all actions. You know, you're knocking, you're seeking, you're asking. So you're active in that process, and that's what the book is all about. It's all about people taking action, praying, asking God to give them wisdom, to give them guidance, to give them those ideas and those action plans as well. And if I can mention, George, we're making the book available for free, the e-book version of it, the Kindle version, which you don't need a Kindle or any special device. But it's free for people that want to get this book on praying for a financial miracle. You just go to Amazon, you'll find it there, or you can go to my website. There's a link there, and you can get the book for free.
Perfect. Now, tell us the story of your repossessed car.
Right. Yeah. So we had two cars, and like I had said earlier, I could have paid cash for my cars, but I thought, look, this is money that could be better used in my business, so I'll just take out loans on these cars, and I'll just cash flow it out of my business, which is what I did. So when the businesses failed and I lost all my money, my cars were going to be repossessed. So rather than have the embarrassment of that, I decided I would call the dealers and just make arrangements to turn the cars back in. So I did. I remember taking my beautiful Cadillac in and, you know, oh my goodness, $60,000 car. I just love that car. And, drove it up, gave the keys to the guy, and he couldn't have been nicer. He said, you know, we all have ups and we all have downs, and you'll be back. And I just want to thank you for your business. Thank you for being a gentleman and bringing the car back. And so said goodbye to my Cadillac. My wife had more of a family car, a station wagon. We had to turn that back in. So there we were, no cars. So how are we going to get around? So we went to the classified ads. We found the car we could buy from my wife for $1,500 cash, which we bought. And that car turned out to be a wonderful car that we drove. She had that for 3-4 years. She said, I love this car. It would turn out to be a fantastic car. And then someone gave me a car to drive for as long as I needed to, which was about a year I needed to use that car. And I was able to just drive that car. It wasn't a Cadillac. It was a Ford Ranger truck, but it was a fairly new one, and I enjoyed it.
And durable. Those are great, great trucks.
And it had air conditioning, so that was good in Florida. That was all I needed.
How about the house? What happened here? You went from a large house to a small house to what happened?
So what happened was, when you go through foreclosure, it takes several months. Now, I know today foreclosure can take 2-3 years.
Could be even longer, yeah.
Yeah, back then you could actually go through foreclosure in about 6 to 9 months. So we started missing our mortgage payments, and we knew that it was just a matter of time before we were going to lose the house. And, you know, if you're a father with 3 young kids, and my kids were young at the time, my youngest, I believe, was just maybe 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old at the time. And so, you know, we had 3 young kids, and we were going to lose our home. And this was the first time, George, that I ever had to move, that it wasn't my choice. I'd always been the kind of guy like, well, let's go pick out another house. We're going to relocate to Dallas, and we're going to buy this home. And I call the realtor, and they take me out. And, Mr. Paris, we're going to show you these 5 houses, and the mortgage people have already approved you. And that was sort of my life. But here I was. I'm losing my home. So every night I'd go to bed. What am I going to do when we lose the house? I'll never forget one night my youngest daughter, I don't know what she was, maybe 4 or 5 years old at the time. She came into my office at the house, and she said, she looked up at me. She said, Daddy, Mommy and I have been praying, are we going to be able to keep our house? Oh, this geez. Is my little girl. And I said, everything's going to be fine. And when she left my office, I closed the door, and I cried like a baby. I just collapsed. I just said, God, what are you doing to me here? I mean, this is my little daughter is asking me, can we keep the house? I mean, how could it get any worse? And so this was a nightmare, and the days were approaching. We're going to lose the house. So finally, the day comes. We're going to lose the house. So about a week or two before that, I was diligently out looking, trying to make some kind of a deal to get into another house. And something just happened. I saw an ad. I called the number. I went out, I met a lady, she liked me, I liked her, I had some money that I had saved up to be able to give her a little bit of money to move in because of not paying my mortgage payment, because there's no point doing that at a certain point.
Sure.
You know, you're going to lose the house.
So save what you can. Right?
So I end up, George, moving into a bigger house, and
amazing.
It was unbelievable. I was so worried, I was throwing up blood, this is how worried I got, and after all that worrying, we move out of the house that we lost to foreclosure, move into another house that I had a lease with an option to buy on it. So I was able to work out a deal to actually end up buying that house at some point in that process.
You were able to get a mortgage again?
Not a mortgage right away, but I did a lease option
okay.
on that particular house and built up some equity. And then we were able to get a mortgage a little bit later in just my wife's
when
name.
Things got better. Yeah.
Right, right. But my kids, I was so worried about my kids, you know, a dad, you know, and my kids are going to lose their home. They loved the new house. That my son, I'll never forget, I walked in. My son had his Nerf basketball hoop set up already on the wall in the kitchen, and he was taking 10-foot jump shots across the kitchen. He said, hey, Dad, this kitchen's bigger. Look at this shot that I can make. He's shooting across the kitchen. In the other house, my 2 girls had to share a room. This house had an extra bedroom beyond what we had at the other house, so they all got their own room, and the only squabbling going on was who was going to get what room. And I think my wife settled that over a game of Monopoly or something, who got to pick what room. But it was just, I just thought to myself, wow, what was I worried about? Look at this. This is like Christmas morning. We're moving into this new house. And I was worried for months and months and months thinking maybe we're going to be homeless. And I end up moving into a bigger house after all.
Money is not the barometer, as you know. And you've been through it. You've been up. You've been down. You've been up. It's nice to have, but it's not the end all, is it?
No, and I'll tell you what, I know people with a lot of money who are very, very unhappy people. In fact, tonight on my radio show, I gave a little comment about the death of Whitney Houston's daughter, which is such a tragedy, and the funeral was today. And so many times what we do is we look at people, the famous, the celebrities, the people that are the super rich, and we think, hey, I wish I were them. I wish I had that life. But, you know, sometimes money and fame can really be a curse. And I think that it's not how much money that you have, because I'll tell you what, there are so many things you can do if you're smart with your money. If you're a good manager, what I call a good steward of your money, you can do so many things. I just bought a trip to Italy. My wife and I were going to Italy for 8 days in the spring, round trip air, 8 days of our hotel, a rental car, all of that for $1,600. We got that.
That's amazing. That's a great deal.
Yeah, so this is the kind of thing we do at our website at ChristianMoney.com. We're always sharing with people tips, things you can do. You know, when you're going to the grocery store, different deals, ways that you can stretch your money a little bit further. But I'll tell you what, money can make you miserable if you make it the center of your life. But I know some really happy people that don't have much. And I know some folks that have a lot of money and are not happy at all. I just don't think it's about the amount that you have, because I've seen too many examples where that rule would be broken.
I think people just want to have some necessities, right? A little roof over their head, something nice to drive around in, maybe a nice little career or job, but you don't have to be really wealthy.
Yeah, you know, you're 100% right. I'll tell you, one of the things that my wife and I laugh about, I have a 22-foot sailboat in a marina that has 50-foot and 100-foot and 100-foot-plus boats in there, okay? I'm one of the smaller boats, but my wife and I were sailing down the Intracoastal, sailing up to St. Augustine, and I said to her, you know what? We have the same view. We have the same dolphin swimming alongside our boat. We've got the same experience here as these people with these big giant boats. And you know what the yacht, the harbor master told me? He said, Mr. Paris, he said, I love the fact that you're out on your boat so much. He said, these people with these big boats, they're working so hard to pay for these boats, they never get to go out on their boats. He told me some of the largest boats in the yacht club there are rarely, if ever, used, because the owners are just so wrapped up in whatever business it is they're involved in to be able to pay for that yacht.
Gee, it'd be cheaper just to rent one and go out once in a while, right?
You're exactly right. You're exactly right.
I've got a friend of mine, he owns a place in Mexico, and he very rarely visits it, maybe once a year for a week. And I'm saying, for the money he spends, he could go to the greatest hotel in the world down there and have a great time and still save money.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. A lot of it is just how we spend our money, how we manage our money. And, you know, no matter how much money I have, I've always been pretty frugal. But I find it to be a great challenge, you know, to go get the 2-for-1 deal or the 3-for-1 deal. You know, I'm always looking for the bargains, and there's a lot of fun in that too. And I think God blesses us when we're good managers of our money as well.
You know, I do a lot of speaking engagements all the time, and I travel coach, and the venue people always say, well, you don't want to go first class? I guess they're used to that. I go, no, I want to go coach. Anyways, we're going to come back with James Paris. We will take phone calls, your advice, but also, if you've been so despondent like he was that you almost took your life, would you share that with us?